about.
Well, thank you very much. Thank you very much. You see, I just came in from South Africa, and I was wearing the wrong mock-up. I'm very sorry. If it occasioned any difficulties in the audience, why, let me know, and I'll process it out. Now, for those few who didn't understand it was a gag, let me introduce the lion. Thank you. How are you? Well, I guess we've got a Congress. Have we?
Yeah.
Well, by golly, I'm real glad to see you people. I didn't think I was going to get here. I took off from Rome. That's a small area that still thinks it's in charge of the world. You know, they haven't changed the thing in Rome, by the way. You know, they still give you bath towels you can't lift, you know. Still overcharge you for everything. Same rackets. Anyway, I took off from Rome after waiting in the station there for 6 hours. And we flew all over the North Atlantic. And we flew all over the North Atlantic to such a degree we couldn't get into New York. Sleet and snow, you see. So they took off and went back to Newfoundland. By this time, any fish in the North Atlantic that sees me again will say, "Hello, Ron." But after spending a night with an Eskimo, you know, Albert, he always lands on his feet. Anyway, I managed to get here, and I'm awful glad to see you. So, hello. Now, factually, this here Congress, we have so much to talk about this Congress that we're going to have to give a 4-day Congress here in these next 2 days. Hope that's all right with you. It's very difficult, you know, giving a 4-day Congress in 2 days because you live the time track twice. And you have to keep your eye on it because as the time track goes up, you see, and back to go up again, you're liable to get stuck on this go-back, you know, and find yourself in 1960, and God forbid. Well, I can't see much of you there at the moment. We've put out the house lights. But you feel good. You feel very good. And personally, if I have many more 1960s, why, you won't be bothered by any more of these lectures. This has been a rough year. This was the year of the great, well, I would say the great change. This was the year when we stopped retreating and started attacking. This was the year when we decided we had been backward long enough and when we reversed the blow. I want to talk to you a little bit about the history of clearing, may I? It has a lot to do with this. Dianetics and Scientology now are really about 30 years old. Only 10 years of this have we been together, besides those times on the backtrack. Yeah. Occasionally we do meet each other on the backtrack, you know. I mean, we have. I've run into a few instances. Friends, I remember being just a little bit late relieving a garrison in Numidia or someplace, and Susie has never forgiven me. She keeps saying every once in a while, muttering to herself, "There you were, stopping at every tavern, But even these things can be processed out. Probably the genesis of Dianetics and Scientology lies in the late 20s, really, when I was a young kid in the Orient. Strange place for a young American to be, watching all sorts of oddities, seeing nonsense such as little boys jump up to the top of ropes that weren't there, and people worrying and wondering about what the soul and mind were all about. And the more they seemed to know about it, the more impoverished they seemed to be, so I decided they didn't know much about it. But I thought, well, the Western civilizations have it all taped. America has it all taped. America knows everything. So while I was going to George Washington University, I conducted a series of tests, which actually they were tests of poetry, of all things. I found out that poetry gives off the same wavelength in any language. And I was testing it out on Kinney photometers. I said, what's this all about? So I went over to the psychology department, and there was a fellow over in the psychology department. I believe he's still alive here in Washington. He said, where are you from? I said, I'm from the engineering school. He said, why don't you stay there? I said, well, I would happily, but I just want to know some of the stuff that you chaps have already got taped, you know. You know, some of the stuff you've already got figured out and so forth. And do all minds react the same to poetry? You know, is there a repetitive wavelength that goes through all minds and are all minds the same? They said, you say you were from the engineering school? And I said, yes. He said, well, poetry belongs in the arts college. So you know me, I got right down to cases, and I says, do you know anything about this or don't you? And I made the horrifying discovery in 1931 that nobody had the mind taped. That was it. It was a totally wide open field. There was philosophy, but there was nothing that had anything to do with the mind. Not really. There were a bunch of suppositions. Back in the 1600s, there was something called faculty psychology that was taught by the Catholic Church. It had to do with the examination of perception. And I found out in 1870, a fellow by the name of Wundt had decided we were all animals. He didn't have any evidence. He wasn't there. And he had established a modern school known as psychology. But psychology is defined this way. Psyche-ology. Spirit, study of. First line of any textbook in psychology is likely to run as follows. Of course, we knew nothing about the spirit, or whether it even exists. This psyche-ology, and we don't know if the spirit exists, and yet this is the study of the spirit. Psyche, spirit. Well, what is this thing called psychology? What is this thing called mind? What is this all about? I tried to find the smallest particle of energy, was what I was looking for, and I concluded it must be in the human mind. I put out a theory at that time, which, by the way, got currency in Austria. And it ran this way. It said, I figured out how many perceptions there were. I didn't know there were 53 at that time. I thought there were some 15 or something like that. And figuring that the eye ran at the rate of a 25th of a second. They now claim it runs at a 10th, but mine runs at a 35th, so some argument there. Man taking mental image pictures and recording them must be storing them someplace. All right, that's fine. But the calculation was that protein molecules, if they have holes in them, might require the storage, I've forgotten the actual figures, 100 memories per hole and 20 holes to a molecule or something like this. and it comes out to the matter of 10 to the 21st powered binary digits of neurons, and if everything a man experienced in 3 months was so recorded and so stored, he had exhausted his entire memory supply, and nobody could possibly remember longer than 3 months ago. Something wrong with this. But I put it out as a theory to demonstrate that man couldn't possibly remember mechanically. And in Austria, they put out the theory again from that original paper, saying that this was how man remembered. I thought, somebody's all rizzing around here. But going forward from that time, it was not until 1938 that I had a common denominator of all livingness. I had studied amongst very primitive cultures, and at the Explorers Club, by the way, I'm known for that field, the field of ethnology. Not archaeology, as they call it in the colleges. It's ethnology, an ethnical field. Primitive cultures. And I knew, I had evidence that survival was a common denominator to all these races. This is apparently what they were trying to do and possibly would work out as a common denominator to all life. And going along in that wise, did quite a bit of research, which actually culminated, theoretically, in 1938. I was up at the Explorers Club and ran head-on to our first international complications, which is why we fight on an international front. I better tell you about this because you will wonder and think I am opinionated and against people unless I tell you about this. This is old news to a lot of you. I'm trying to tell it the same way, too. works this way. Any government these days is terribly interested in how the mind works, but dead against anybody that knows more about it than they do. Figure that one out. I was at the Explorers Club for tea, and there was a fellow there whose name was Commissar Galinsky. He was from AMTORG, the American-Russian Trading Organization, which at that time served as the... Well, we had no diplomatic relations with Russia, and they served actually as the diplomatic channel, AMTORG, New York. And this Russian smiled at me, and he said, "I've been hearing about your researches from some of your friends. I understand that you know something about what makes man work and how you can select men who will work and men who won't work." I said, "Well, that might or might not be," rather defensively. And he says, "Well," he said, "I'll tell you." He said, "We'd be very happy to make you an offer. As a matter of fact, I can have you talking to Stalin in about 3 weeks. We'll just fly over and talk to him." They were hiring lots of engineers for various things in those days. And I said, "Well," I said, "I'm awfully, awfully engaged. I said, as a matter of fact, I know a blonde up on Amsterdam Avenue." No, that's another story. "And I have commitments in the United States. And I won't be able to go to Russia, thank you." Next time I saw him at tea at the Explorers Club, which is quite international, by the way, it still carried Nazi officers as members, clear to the end of World War II, famous explorers in Germany, famous explorers in Russia. All sorts of the Allies and the enemy and everything else still held memberships of the Explorers Club, and the Explorers Club was being very, very careful not to cancel out their memberships before they knew whether or not they were missing or had forgotten to pay or were unable to pay. So he says to me, he says, "We've taken this up with Russia, with our government, and we're willing to offer you Pavlov's old quarters and $200,000 and all your expenses for further researches." Well, of course, I didn't have very much money in those days. I thought, $200,000. Only trouble is, it'll probably be paid in shin plasters or something of the sort. I said, "No, thank you. No, thank you." I said, I don't think I'd like to go. He said, "Well, come over and have dinner with us. Come over and have dinner with us and talk it over." Well, I had dinner with him and talked it over and said no.
And they said, yes. And I said, no. And they said, yes. Well, that was the end of a beautiful friendship. And that end has lasted to this day. The commie doesn't like us. Not because they wouldn't be happy to use the information. Not because they wouldn't be happy to use these organizations. Not because they're against anything we believe in at all. But I said no. About 2 years later, they broke into my quarters, or some unknown people did, something on that order, 2-3 years later, and stole the original manuscripts of this. I have a flimsy copy of the first manuscript of this subject, which has never been published. It's not, however, complete. I've got had withholds on you. The Russians have got the original. Well, all went along very well, and we got into a war. Do you remember there was a war? The war that ended nothing, except some of our healths and finances. World War II, they called it. Well, this silly mess came along, and a lot of us went over and did various things. And after that, I had done quite a bit of study in the last year of that war, the endocrine systems and a bunch of things, and it did an enormous amount of work in 46 and 47, which finally culminated in the writing of the book Dianetics, Modern Science of Mental Health, published in very early 1950. May, actually. Well, just about the time it hit the stands, I was in Washington, D.C., this very same city, and a very high-ranking officer, a very, very, very high-ranking officer, you know, brass, you know, brass, scrambled eggs, you know, gilt on the cape edge, you know, wow, you know, just look at him blinding. I was teaching some of the psychiatrists here in Washington how to run engrams, or trying to. The last effort we made, I think. We did make a sincere effort, by the way, to give Dianetics to psychiatry, to the medical profession, to teach them how to use it, and so forth. And we found out they didn't know what they were doing, and we skipped it. That happened clear back then. So don't think it's anything new when we claw up psychiatrists or something of the sort. They started it. They kept asking me too many stupid questions in lectures I was given. I never forgave them. Anyway, this bunch of scrambled eggs comes walking up the steps, and it was on a Monday. And he said to me, "Well, well, Hubbard, how are you? You know, how are you?" I said, "What's this guy want?" "How would you like to work for the Office of Naval Research?" I said, "Doing what?" "Oh, using what you know about the mind, you know, to make people more suggestible." I won't announce this man's rank or name, not in the public. But I said, "Well, sir," it was an underscore, and "sir" was in italics. "Sir," I said, "I'm not interested." After all, the book had just been published. The first foundation was just forming. We were just kicking off. And this guy wants to drag me into the Navy. He says, "Well," he said, "you'd better watch out." "You'd better watch out." "Because I can pull you back in to service at your old rank." Oh, I said, "Here we go." So he left feeling very complacent. And I immediately got on telephones. I had to find some place in the United States, a naval district, that was stupid enough to let me resign. And I found them, God bless them, right down here at the end of Pennsylvania Avenue. The Potomac River Naval Command, which was set up during the Civil War to patrol the Confederate States.
and was still a full naval district. Marvelous. It had admirals and everything, and I went in going... I had a service record, and I had my health record, and I had my resignation all written out. And factually, up until 1947, I was unable to walk without a cane. I couldn't see. I was blind. I got processing about that time, however, and ruined my naval record. And I showed the old admiral down there how I could never be of any use again to the Navy, showing him all the casualties, you know, and sheets of paper, and... Oh, he says, "You poor fellow." And I said, "Yes, that's right, that's right." And he says, "You poor fellow. Yes, I'll accept your resignation." They rushed it up, got a special assistant to the Secretary of the Navy to okay it. And on Thursday, when the high brass came back to see me again, he says, "Well, have you decided?" "Yes." I said, "I've decided not to go in." He says, "Well," he said, "I guess I have no other choice but to draft you in at your old rank." And I said, "I'm very sorry." Omitting the "sir" italicized. "I'm very sorry, but I'm no longer a member of the armed services." He says, "What's this?" I said, "Yes, as a matter of fact, here it is. Here's Secretary of the Navy. It's okay. Set the bucket." And that was an end of a beautiful friendship with the American government. I have to tell you all this because it's not that it's terribly important, but it's very interesting from a standpoint of we have kicked in the teeth and have overts against the Russian government and the American government. And you wonder sometimes why the American government or something like that doesn't, in a great burst of enthusiasm, set up a $100 billion project to fix up all of their pilots so they can fly airplanes, and their radar operators so they can watch radar, and their scientists so they can think. It goes right back to that engram. Office of Naval Research. Hubbard said no. To hell with him. Well, remember, they didn't make up their minds that we were no good and we were Gyps and Clips and Stiffs and McGee's until we had said no. That's an important point. That's a very important point. We have not made friends or influenced people in those departments. But it has left us free. And we probably today are the only free organization on the face of Earth. And that is saying something. Because we are the only organization on the face of Earth which is winning flat out right this minute. The things I have to tell you in this Congress, you will at first perhaps temper a little bit by saying, "Ron has been optimistic before." I'm not being optimistic now. It's been my lot for 11 years to keep you from losing heart, to keep the show on the road and keep the gains and advances which he could obtain being gained and being advanced. And that's been my role for 11 years. So I could do the research and train people with enough background so that we could keep it rolling. I knew that we couldn't clear everybody who walked up to us. I knew that. Now, if I never made that succinctly plain, although I believe I have told you that from time to time, it was because I didn't want to dampen your ardor or upset you. But let me tell you this, it's been a mighty hard job keeping the show on the road, and if you hadn't been with me on it, it would have been a long time dead. So thank you very much for the part you have played in it. Thank you. Now, as we look over our accomplishments, we find they are many. And I have several things that I could announce to you and then explain to you later. But I think I'd better announce these things. Looking over the political background, it is not odd to find that we today float free
of political commitments. We are not owned. This is the one organization on earth that isn't owned and owes no favors. If we're for something, we simply think it's a good thing to be for. If we're against something, we just think they're no good. I'm afraid there is no college professor in America could make the statement. I've had very many vivid illustrations of that fact. They have to think of their jobs. They have to think of the party line of the Republican Party or the something of the sort, you know. They have to think about what they're doing. They have to be consistently and continually alert to what they say. They can never be totally honest. We can be honest, and it sometimes steps all over people's toes. But for that very reason, we have enough verve to win. A few months ago, we licked communism in Australia. Just like that. The biggest communist publication in Australia devoted the entirety of an article to an apology to us for all the dirty, nasty, vicious things they've been saying about Scientology. Magazine's name is The Nation. The British Medical Association, unfortunately, went into collusion with the Communist Party in Australia. Don't ask me why. They have no part of the British Medical Association of England, by the way. They're Australian. But all of the statements being made by one of their fellows, the top man, I don't know, you had a fellow over here that was kind of this kind of a louse. Let's see, what was his name? Morris Fishcake. I think that was his name. He got sued, by the way, for pretending to be a doctor in Texas. And they awarded $10 million damages to the person who sued him. Did you know that was what happened to Morris Fishcake over here? That's right. Yeah, he pretended to be a doctor. He was in charge of the American Medical Association at one time. Oh, you don't know these things. They never get publicity somehow. Somehow we never read them on the front page. We read, Christian says, Christian does. But we don't read things like that. I wonder why. Well, anyhow, we'll take that up in the last lecture. The point I'm making here is they thought they could clean up on Scientology in Australia. They thought they could do it. They got a practitioner in Scientology who was somewhat squirrely, who was operating up in Perth and who had already gotten out of England because the organization was on his heels. And they tagged him with an arrest for practicing medicine without a license. This made them very brave. They waited for months. They carefully prepared a campaign. And evidently, using all communist outlets, the British Medical Association spread a fantastic campaign against Scientology in the country of Australia. Awfully coincidental, isn't it? The British Medical Association using communist outlets. And they tried to put us under the health department of Australia so that we could not practice or operate, so that we would be regulated. And every Scientologist in Australia, united arm to arm, took their pens in hand and under a heavily directed campaign, fought back hard. They wrote every government official in Australia. Everybody was being inundated by mail saying, how is it that the British Medical Association uses communist outlets in Australia? And then we wrote a petition, and Scientologists in Australia took it around to all of the medical doctors, individual medical doctors, who are good Joes and don't have anything to do with their own associations. And yeah, they're kind of slaves. That's right. We wrote a petition that said, we do not feel that we are such expert healers that we should block all fields of healing, and we don't feel that we know all there is to know about healing, and that we are not presumptuous asses after all. And therefore, we hereby do petition the legislature and parliament to soften their medical legislation and abolish the monopolistic appearance of the British Medical Association in Australia. And these medicos, you know, Scientologists would walk up and say, would you please sign this petition? What the devil is this? What's this? Have we lost? It's the kind of a document that you'd only sign if you had lost a war the hard way. Total surrender, see? And of course, none of them signed them, but they turned around and cut their own association to ribbons. And when they found out their own association chiefs were using communist channels, they turned around and cut communism to ribbons. They chopped everything up, and all of a sudden, a very contrite government wrote us a letter and said, please, 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 we're not going to put you under the health department. We're not going to do anything to you. You have a perfect right to practice. Go away. I think party line in Australia now is don't say anything about Scientology. But you know, we haven't even heard them talking in general. We have learned something. We have learned that they are very afraid people and that they run. And all you have to say is boo. The United States will always have in it people who will reason that you shouldn't fight the enemy. As a matter of fact, that's all I have to find fault with generals and admirals. They won't let you fight. You see, to be a general or admiral, one has to get promoted. And to be promoted, one must never do anything bad or wrong. And to never do anything bad or wrong, you have to have good training from your mother. And mothers don't like you to fight. So all the generals and admirals are usually trained not to fight and not to let other people fight. And we win wars in spite of them. I've said, well, so they've sold out to the enemy. That's all right. Go ahead and fight. And we keep winning wars. We can win wars in spite of the fact we have generals and admirals and politicians. They're not the fellows who do any of the fighting anyhow. Have you ever noticed one out with a Tommy gun? Have you ever? You ever seen them out fighting in the trenches? I never have. I remember I used to say, well, it's a good thing all the admirals that we have are very experienced in our particular branch of warfare, because their experience has taught us an awful lot. Taught us an awful lot here in World War II. Taught us an awful lot. All you have to do is read their orders and know what you should do. Do the opposite. It's a bitter war. There are always people in a country who will tell you not to fight the enemy. There are always people who will tell you that it's not nice to fight. These people also think it's not nice to win. But today, across the world, we are winning. And not because we're not fighting. You see, we're in the wonderful position of being able to run out the consequences of having attacked somebody. Before we get the motivator. Now, there's one very signal victory. That's a very calm, beautifully affluent, non-attacked area of the world right now, Australia is. Of course, you have to keep fighting for liberty or the right to do. South Africa, I'll tell you more about South Africa, is a wonderful example of this sort of thing. We're winning there. 1954, 55, 56, all American activities and Scientology were bitterly fought in England. But that's all passed away. That's passed away. There isn't any fight left in the opposition. They had actually fixed it up so I couldn't really enter the country. And all sorts of weird things were in the files. And I finally got some members of the British Parliament to go through the immigration files and clean out all this nonsense planted in it. And they cleaned it all out, and after that they say, you want to stay a year, stay a year. You want to stay 10 years, stay 10 years. You're all right with us. You can win. That was all commie pressure. In the early days here in America, we had a tremendous amount of trouble with communism. It's either communists cause trouble, or they want to cause trouble, or people at a level that cause trouble become communists. Whatever the answer is, we had trouble with them. We're not having any trouble with them now. They'd think a long time before anybody launched an attack against a Scientology organization in the United States. We have hit back so hard. We hit back so out of proportion to the amount we're attacked that we win. I'm not joking. Constant and continual alertness is the price of freedom. Constant willingness to fight back is the price of freedom. There is no other price, actually. And we have stayed across the world a free organization. There isn't anybody we have to take our hats off to. Nobody. The psychiatrists of any country are captives of that country. Do you realize that? The government brings in somebody and says, electric shock this fellow, he's politically unacceptable to us. They electric shock him. Why? Because most of those institutional posts are government-paid posts. Everybody'd lose his job. You get the idea? We are a free people. And we may be the last free people on earth. I don't wish to exaggerate, but we very well may be. And in that particular role, we are winning beyond your imagination. There are more people in HPA, HCA classes today, there are more people being processed than there ever were in the early sunburst days of Dianetics. It is enormously bigger. We have administrative and organizational networks of considerable size, effectiveness, and magnitude. We are there. We have an office on every major continent on Earth, and sometimes two. We are people now who are united clear across and all the way around this planet. We're not just Americans. There's hardly any Scientologist holds very heavily with super-nationalism. After all, they've seen too much nationalism cause too many wars. Scientology is not basically American. Too much work has been developed in England for it to remain exclusively American. Too much work and too much activity has occurred elsewhere in the world for it to remain exclusively American. But nevertheless, it has an American impetus and a certain American coloration, because this was where it was generated. You'll find the countries of Earth today are becoming Americanized to an enormous extent, in spite of the government. The only opposition, by the way, we had in Australia was the American consul in Melbourne, who was saying we weren't an American organization. He's since been removed. In spite of the government, Americanism goes abroad. Today, California had better look to its laurels. California had better watch out. California has been complacently sitting there getting a swivel chair spread. California has been sitting there enjoying its smog and holding its suspenders out, you know, and saying, well, we're something on a stick. They better watch out. There's a country called South Africa that's got them taped. Better climate, more Americanization. You'd be amazed today. 1952, the commies were still fighting America very hard abroad. You'd go to a stage play or something like that, you'd hear a lot of anti-American sentiments. Well, they resisted themselves into becoming Americanized. That's about all it amounts to. You don't hear these things now. Stead, where you see the Buicks and the Fords. Ice cream sodas and iced Coca-Cola. You see all the things that appertain to an American civilization. That's natural because we have a better civilization. The world had an old civilization called the Roman civilization. It was the last large export civilization. It was exported to the known world. Now we have a civilization that we are exporting to the known world. The English had for a while. And we actually have taken over their industrialized attitude, and then we have re-exported it. We've added new ruffles and so forth. And we're exporting a civilization today. That makes Scientology have lines to travel along, but it, peculiarly enough, hasn't any real nationalization color. It isn't colored by this nationalization. You'd be surprised how many accents I have heard Scientology vocabularies pronounced in. And you'd be amazed right now how many languages a model session has been translated into. And how many nationalities have their own ideas on the subject of which axiom is most important. We are the largest, and this is the first time I can say this with honesty, we are the largest mental health organization on earth. We have the longest communication lines, the most practitioners, the most people under treatment on earth. We are the world's largest mental health organization. That's pretty hard to believe, particularly with some of you chaps that have been right with it from the beginning. But it's nevertheless entirely true. What makes it true, of course, is all other organizations are national, they are small, they are compact, and they are enslaved, and they don't grow. You add up our communication lines in Scientology, and I don't know how many times they would go round and round the moon. I haven't any idea, but they are long, our communication lines are. We get complaints about it, too. America has no direct telex connection with South Africa, and HCO Washington has been batting its brains out while I've been down in South Africa. Has to go in through London, and there's more lines. We own a tremendous amount of property. We own a tremendous amount of material and so forth, and it keeps growing, but that's not important. When buildings get important to us, for God's sakes, some of you born revolutionists, will you please blow up central headquarters? If somebody had put some HE under the Vatican long ago, Catholicism might still be going. Don't get interested in real estate. Don't get interested in the masses of buildings, because that's not important. What is important is how much service you can give the world, and how much you can get done, and how much better you can make things. These are important things. These are all that are important. A bank account never measured the worth of a man. His ability to help measured his worth, and that's all. A bank account can assist one to help, but where it ceases to do that, it becomes useless. When you're not well fed and you aren't enjoying your favorite breed of cat or something like this, why, maybe you're not in a frame of mind that gives the best possible service. So these things add into it too. You don't have to be a pauper in order to service things. But it's true that we have considerable wealth around the world, but we are growing bigger. On our own initiative, we are growing bigger. We are doing better. Our people are doing better. They are better looking. They know more. They are more effective people. All of these things add up. And now, all of a sudden, all of this is taking place without any change. You understand? This is taking place as a natural consequence of the general growth which began unevenly in 1950 and became rather smooth and gradual from 1956 on. If we just left it at this, if we didn't do anything else at this level, and if we got no more results than we have gotten in the last few years, we would still make it in our lifetimes all the way around the world. Now, we've been aware of this for some time. And look what I've gone and done. Look what I've done. In South Africa, all of a sudden found the gimmick that turns the central organization on full blast. That puts 30 new people off the street a day into the reception room of the central organization. Add it up. 30 new people a day. Poor South Africa. The organization down there had been running along like other central organizations, been doing just fine in its own quiet way, and had been solvent by working its registrars to death and so forth. Its technology was no better than should have been. And then all of a sudden, I throw the switch. Now look, I gave you warning. I gave you warning actually a year ago that I was going to throw the switch. I said the second we had it solved, that every case that walked in was processed perfectly by others than myself, everybody got gains, we had technical wins all the way, and we're clearing right along the line. I said as soon as I was absolutely certain of that, I was going to throw the switch. All right. Sometime in October of 1960, I became aware of the fact that we had it taped. The first St. Hill ACC was moving cases up the line wholesale that had never moved before in years of processing. There were some of those cases that had never moved under processing, and we moved them. We had it taped right there. And then I turned around and I went to that country on earth which has been noted for its toughest cases, South Africa. And I went on an all-out research program, taking off from the data we had in the first St. Hill, to fix it up so the HGC in South Africa would crack every case that came in the first few hours of processing. And I set it up, and in 2.5 months of research, attained that goal, and it is now a fact. So don't think you can upset me now with your case. The 11-year phase of building a better bridge is ended. It has ended totally and for sure. More auditors have to be trained in this, but HGCs which have good HC from their director of processing are uniformly breaking every case that walks in the front door, regardless of the condition it's in and regardless of how close to Freud's totally failed case it is. We are cracking them all. It is now, at this time, when we are capable of delivering a totality of service, that I am willing that switch be thrown. And you wonder, what's held us back all these 11 years? I have. That's right. You ask old Dick sometime if I didn't tell him several years ago. Well, Dick, when we can make it roll all the way across the boards with not a single technical slip, I'll be willing to let it roll. Until that time, I have a very light foot on the accelerator. Because I can promote, I think you know that. But look, it is not safe to let registrars sell tremendous quantities of processing to people unless they are absolutely sure that they can get a result. Now, sure, we've been getting results for years. We have been getting results, very worthwhile results. This has nothing to do, we're not kicking in the head the results you've been getting. But we also, here and there, and worse than here and there, we have been failing on certain cases. Let's admit it.
After all, Freudian analysis never admitted it, and they failed on 110%. They said there were certain cases they couldn't solve. Let's be just as honest and say there are certain cases that we haven't been moving, that's all. They've just been too rough, and that's been going on for the last 11 years. There have been cases here and there that walk in. We got them all on the first St. Hill. I don't know if I ever told Dick and Jan this, but at the last moment on the first St. Hill, I wanted every rough case I could get in England, so I said it required no down payment and no further payments to get in. And, of course, that brought in all the rough cases. Now I tell you, we had all the tough ones, and we moved them all. That was heroic. But it only takes a few failures to kill the impetus of any great forward drive. It only takes a few failures in an organization, or by an organization, or by its HGC, you see, to discourage it. Let's say it has 100 wins and it has 10 failures. Those 10 failures still pile up. You never saw anything as cocky right now as a Johannesburg HGC auditor. There are a tremendous number of auditors on that staff now, by the way. I've forgotten how many. I should have gotten some statistics of the last few weeks, how many PCs per week they're getting on there. I did it by the simple expedient of saying Mary Sue was going to run the HGC for a little while, and she did. And she did a terrific job, as she always does. And she's running mobs of feces, you know, mobs of them. And it's up somewhere around 34 or 39 PCs a week, something on this order. It's way up there. And these auditors are getting insufferable. The HGC assistant admin came into my office the other day and said, "Well, Ron, when would you like some processing?" I never saw a man quite as cocky as that. It was perfectly all right with him to offer me some processing, but I took a look at him while he was doing this. A lot of auditors offered me processing, and I accepted. But I took a look at this boy, and I thought, my golly, there's what Freud would call a swollen id. They're insufferable. Poor PC comes in and says, "I have worked for years to gather up these tremendous problems which are totally unsolvable." And the auditor says, "Yes, yes." "Okay, now let's see." And the PC says, "And I have not been able to get along with my husband. And I'm a mystic. And I'll be able to sit here and worry you practically into your grave." The auditor says, "Well, that's good, fine. Start." And there goes the case. There it goes. First few hours, it's on its road, that's it. These boys are doing it. Now, some of these fellows are field auditors who have just been pulled back on staff, have been briefed by the training officer of the HGC, and who have been sicked onto the PC, not even knowing what the tools could do, but knowing better than to shift that far off. They have in South Africa what they call a shambok. It's a little whip, rhinoceros hide, you know. And they don't use a shambok in the HGC. That's too mild. An auditor departs from routine, why, he's practically had it. And they just hold these fellows right on routine, and all of a sudden the fellow gets this terrific certainty. See? Zoom! Here he goes. Well, we haven't worked with other central organizations, but they've been using these processes, and they've been doing very, very well. But here's an example of a high concentration of it. Now it's safe to open that front door. Take them all. Take them all. Because there are going to be no losers along the line. And if there are no losers along the line, what's that going to add up to? Look how much power we've won already on the fact that we still could have some losers. It isn't
clearing cases that has held us up. It's starting cases that has held us up. Getting cases started. If we get them started, we can clear them. Getting them started into stable gains, that's been our problem. And we can sweep them all up these days. And I've turned on a new program down there that's bringing in 30 new people walking off the pavement a day into Scientology. And that's an awful lot of people. No, we've got dissemination solved. We have the administration end of it solved. We have 11 years have been digging our forward trenches and sinking in the concrete and getting ourselves ready to launch an assault. And even before we launch it, we find ourselves the largest mental health organization on earth. I know I've looked at the figures. And we are right this minute. And we are a free organization owing no allegiance to any government or financial or politically interested group. We are a totally free group. Where do we go from here? If we've gone this far with occasionally broken weapons, with their own cases falling in, with various other things happening, without organizational know-how, if we've gone this far in this condition, how far are we going to go now? Well, I can tell you frankly, we're going to go all the way. So here you are. Some Scientologists don't like this. They don't like it because the old exclusive club tie atmosphere doesn't become the total atmosphere. You also have this other atmosphere of the public storming up and saying, I want some, what do you call it, processing. When did Freud invent Scientology? And some Scientologists, by the way, they look at this and they quail because it's the raw public, you know, in droves coming around for service, demanding it. The old school tie, however, still obtains. I'll never forget the guys that have been with it for 11 years, because this is our show, isn't it? And I'm real happy to be able to announce to you that I decided to turn the switch, that we've got it licked technically, and we're over the hump, and we're away. You can sit there complacently and be very comfortable and not have to believe it for the moment. It doesn't have to be real to you. I won't insist. But it's like the German soldier that was standing in a trench, and a Gurkha, who had long knives during World War I, came over and he swished at the German soldier's head, and the German soldier said, "You miss me." And the Gurkha said, "Shake your head, Fritzy." I'm afraid the reality of this will all too soon be upon us. You're just about to inherit this planet, whether you like it or not. I can only hope that you're in good enough shape to like it. Thank you.